Hello, very good evening to you all. It's my enormous pleasure to be here today. It's a great honor. I'm very thankful to Michael and Matthew for having invited me here. Exactly 10 years ago, I met this wonderful man at the University of Leeds, where he was presenting the documentary film Santiago that had just been launched at that point. And in conversation with him, he assured to me that that was his last film. And I'm so delighted that he contradicted himself by releasing another film, but he took 10 years to change his mind about it. I was also asked by my Michael Temple to make a brief introduction of João. It's so difficult to do that because it's so much encapsulated in one person and also in one family, the Moreira Salles family in Brazil, who have been benefactors of the arts for decades. The work, well, I asked João Moreira Salles how I should define him, and I said, can I say you are a documentarist? And he said, you can say I am a reluctant documentarist, because he's many other things. And when in this interval between Santiago and No Intenso Agora, he devoted himself to the development of a political magazine called Piauí, and also to the running of the Institute Moreira Salles, which supports the arts in general, but in particular photography. And he started in the cinema with his brother Walter Salles, who started as a documentarist and then moved on to fiction film. And I think he was kind of taken into that route that now seems to run in the blood of the family as well, because we discovered that his mother was an amateur filmmaker as well. I think it's enough. I mean, otherwise it's going to be too much. And if I could just start by talking a little bit about this long gap in your career and your reluctance to be a documentarist. Could you say something about that, Sas?
Thanks, Lucia. Thanks for all of you staying here so late. And thanks for the invitation from the SA Film Festival. Well, it's you're right to say that my brother Walter is the actual filmmaker in the family. I mean, that's his vocation. Yeah, no, it was his vocation since he was fairly young, so he knew he wanted to be that. I never grew to up to a point where I actually knew what I was going to be I was leaving Brazil to go to the US for a PhD in economics when my brother came back from Japan, and he brought a couple of hours of images he has shot in Japan and interviews, and he asked me to help him put this thing together, and so I did. And this was between the gap of the end of the year in Brazil in the South Hemisphere and the beginning of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, so I had 6 months, and I did it. It worked, and so I had a good reason not to leave Brazil, and so I stayed, but basically because he invited me to help him. So I have this idea that if he were a dentist, I would be doing root canals right now. But it never became a true vocation, to tell you the truth. So in 2005 or 2004, when I decided to make this film called Santiago, it had the feeling for me that there I ended the whole period of thinking about nonfiction film and my ideas about the genre were kind of encapsulated in the film, and I didn't have a reason to go on, and I was already thinking about journalism, and I launched the magazine at the same time that the film screened in Brazil and then in several festivals outside of Brazil. And so for the next 10 years I actually changed my not really the thing I do, but the profession, yes, because I started to write and not to film, but basically nonfiction, basically shaping reality in a way and giving, representing reality, but now in writing and not filming. Film is a very expensive thing. Brazil is a very unequal society, as you all know. I wouldn't say a poor country, but an unjust country. And one has to think a lot, why film? Why make a film? Because you're using public funds and so there was always this thing about if I go out in a film, I really have to have a reason to do it, and I didn't have one, which I didn't end my relation with documentaries, because I was up until 2015 when he died, I was the producer of Eduardo Coutinho. A magnificent documentary filmmaker in Brazil. This film is dedicated to him. So while I was running the magazine, at the same time I was producing his films, he was very prolific. He was making a film every 18 months, something like that, as you know. But then suddenly I had this urge to come back to film, because I had found those images of my mother at the end of the Santiago editing process, and they had stuck in my mind, and I wanted to tackle the main theme of the film, I think, which is engagement and then disengagement, being alive and then losing the capacity of happiness, of engagement, of curiosity, and the images that I found of my mother helped me with that, and also the thing that she wrote about it. So I started to see the images, to read the words, and then the film began to take shape, and that's why I decided to come back, because I had a problem to solve, which is the problem of how do you survive the end of a passion, of a moment of high intensity, and then it fades, because it usually always fades, and then you have to find meaning in a life that's more the volume is down, and yet you have to find happiness in that new kind of environment, and that is a problem also it's a thing that I tackle with, and the film helped me with that.
Right. You touched upon the origin of this film being your mom and the discovery of the footage that she had shot in China. Your mother is a kind of semi-mythological figure in Brazil, somebody that we know by hearsay, so to say. We know that she was an extremely beautiful and elegant person who was always in the magazines, in focus like that, and that she had a tragic ending. So your entire film, you talk a lot about death, and in particular, the latter part of your film is a recurrence of the theme of death and of young people dying at 30 years of age, committing suicide, and so on. But you don't really say that thing about the person who matters there.
Yeah. Why?
Why?
I don't know. I don't have a problem saying it. My mother became very, very depressed, and not from one day to the other. It was a process. It took a couple of decades, and she lost her interest in life. She couldn't get out of the hole she was in, and then in 1988 she decided to put an end to her life, which I found was an extremely courageous act. I don't have a problem with that. I think she was brave to make the decision. But still, it's something very personal. And one thing is for me, her son here in front of you, and to say that, we have a connection in some way. We're in the same room. Another thing is to put it in the film. The film is shown. I don't know who's watching in a dark room somewhere. I feel this kind of impropriety in a sense. So, but it is, I think it is insinuated in the film because, I mean, her last sequence is the sequence that comes after all the deaths and the suicides and that dynamic of being completely engaged in a moment in life for different reasons. My mother was not political, so the reason was not political with her. But it was political with the militants of 68. It was political with militants of Brazil in 68. It was political also and tragic for those in Czechoslovakia when the invasion occurred. They're also in the intense now when they take out the cameras just to bear witness of about what's happening in their lives, in their city. And to have that and then to lose that is something that really interests me. And I think that I started to read memoirs of those who went to China in 66, and I came across several memoirs of French Maoists who would become important in the events of May. One of them, particularly Robert Linard, who went there when he was really young. At the same time that my mother was there, wrote a beautiful letter home to his wife saying, I just arrived in paradise. This is what we imagined our whole lives, and now it's here and it exists, and this is what the future will be. So I want you to come here and see that paradise on earth exists. I think these are almost his exact words. Robert Linard would have not a tragic end. He's still alive, and he's a very interesting man. But in May 68, after May 68, he had a breakdown, and he actually wouldn't speak for a couple of years. And when I say he would not speak, he would literally not speak. He wouldn't say good morning, good night. Or he went mute because of the events of 68, and the fact that the Maoists didn't take part of the events of 68, and he thought that might have been a failure of imagination, of judgment. So because of Robert Linard, I started to read the memoirs of those militants of 68, and you see the same kind of dynamic of being completely alive to the moment, and when the moment ceases to exist, you have a hard time finding your foot on the new. And I think that those who are unable to continue are those that are trapped in the nostalgia of something that was wonderful, that was important, that was generous, that was beautiful, but it was circumscribed in a moment and in a place, and it ends. And if you want to relive something that you cannot, I mean, it's a bet you lose always because you cannot go back in time. And I think that nostalgia is the big trap. And I think that my mother was also a victim of nostalgia, in a sense, for other reasons. Nostalgia of her husband, that was not her husband anymore. Nostalgia of her youth, of her beauty, and she was not able to tackle with that. The militants of 68, for different reasons, also could not live the life that came after 68. And the only ones who could were the ones who knew that this could not be relived, and you had to find new fights and new struggles, and several of them were able to do so. I mean, many people from 68 went to Brazil, and actually in 79 and 80 helped to create the Workers' Party. Mm-hmm. Daniel Ben Said, a couple of them. Robert Linard is one of them, was there at the beginning of the Workers' Party in Brazil. Daniel Combendi went into the Green Movement very early on. It was something new at the time, and he was able to understand that this was the new thing that you should actually fight for. Gabeira in Brazil, we know him really well. Gabeira was a was a guerrilla fighter. He went underground to fight the military regime. Actually, he was part of the group who kidnapped the American ambassador. He was caught, he was tortured, he was sent to exile. And when he came back to Brazil, he said, I don't want to tackle with the past. We're having the social configuration now is different, so the fights are different, and I want to face today, not yesterday. And those are able to have productive lives and find meaning. I think this is the thing that I kind of find out doing the film.
Mm-hmm. There is a great fascination with Daniel Combandi. In terms of the way that he catalyzed the dissatisfaction of a whole generation, but without having a program. So without knowing what to do once you have toppled everything that's here. So could you elaborate a little bit? You seem to have read absolutely everything that he wrote.
I really like Combandi for several reasons, and one of them being his imperfections. I think that I'm kind of scared of the perfect ones. Combandi, the film was screened in Paris at a film festival there, and many of the filmmakers were in the audience, and at the end it was a very heated debate. So the anarchists liked the film, the Stalinists hated the film. And the Trotskyites were kind of ambiguous about the film, and they were fighting against each other. And at some point I became silent because they were discussing, they were having the same fights they had in '68 at the Amphitheatre. It was very interesting. The only thing that brings them together, all of them, is that they hate Combandi, all of them. Combandi is a traitor. I don't think he is. I think, first of all, I think that Combandi brings into revolution is not really revolution here, but into social unrest, the element of joy, which I think is very important and deeply political. Mm-hmm. I agree with his statement. It's not in the film, but he says, it is in the film. The greatest anti-communist propaganda is Sunday afternoon in East Berlin. And I think he's right about that. You wouldn't like to live in a society as gloomy as that. So joy is an important thing. Maybe being Brazilian, we're kind of more of attuned to that. But I think that joy is something that really. You don't link joy and revolt. They're not together. With Combandi, they are. And there's this thing which I find very interesting, which is the fact that he doesn't want to have a program, and the fact that he thinks that spontaneity is important, and what he wants to do is to give a shock to the system, and then the system will reconfigure itself because of the shock, and what happens. So. We were having a chat outside, and I was telling Lucia something that I really find interesting, and it's not my insight. It's the insight of a very young activist in Brazil, who took part in 2013, the events of 2013 in Brazil, who were huge, 2 million people out in the streets protesting against the state, not even the government, but the state. And in various discussions I had about the film, in which this guy, Miguel was his name, was in the audience, he heard me saying that I think that '68 in the United States and in London was far more interesting and creative and in a sense subversive than '68 in Paris. Because there were drugs and music and sexuality and everything that in France is very, very, very conservative. Combandi is one to see that, and he takes note. And Miguel, at some point, he raised his hand and said, I don't agree. And I don't agree for one reason. Everything you're saying is right. But hairs are short, only men are speaking, and in the United States, you have the Black Movement, you have the Panthers, you have Angela Davis, you have the hippies, you have drugs. It's and in London also. But there's one thing that Paris has that no other place has, which is Paris doesn't have a cause, and that's very important. So in the United States, you had a war. And there was a good reason to go out into the streets, right? You didn't want to die, and you didn't want to kill also innocent people in Vietnam. In Brazil, you had the military regime. In Prague, you had the invasion. In Mexico, you had, I mean, the establishment, the old establishment. In France, it was different, because in France, they were at the tail end of a huge period of prosperity, full employment, wages going up, a fairly substantial public health system, a fairly substantial educational system, much more than the United States, which till this day doesn't have one. And yet, and that's where I think Miguel says something that's very perceptive. He says, and yet those kids who came from privilege went out into the streets and say, although you give us all that, this is not enough. We don't want to conform. We don't want a bourgeois life. We don't want a job at Citroën. We don't want to marry and have 1.5 kids. We don't want to. We want to live in a different way. We want to be one with the workers. We want workers in the university. We want to try our hands in the factories. Of course, it was romantic. It was idealized. It never happened, or it happened really very, very briefly, very fittingly. This is one on the 13th of May. There was a huge march across Paris where students and workers marched for the only first and last time. But workers on one side, students on the other side. If you see the funeral of Totin, who died in solidarity to workers, there's not one single worker marching on Totin's funeral. And if you see the funeral of Belot, the worker, there's not one single student. So it really didn't happen, which is a reason also for the sadness that came afterward. But still, at some point, it was sincere. They wanted that. And they said, although you give me everything, everything that you give me is not enough, because this is not the life we want. And Miguel says, well, this is the prototype of movements that we will see on the 21st century. Think of Occupy, think of Brazil 2013, think of London, and the riots. And the reason, the thing that brings those movements together is the fact that, one, they don't trust any representative body. So in Paris in 68, those students were from the left. They didn't see each other in the Communist Party anymore, or at the unions, the CGT. They didn't trust them anymore. They didn't trust the big professors, the maître à penser. You see Sartre speaking, and the guy is sleeping next to Sartre. So you don't delegate anymore. It's you, your voice, and you will say what you think and what you wish and what you want. It's very horizontal. There's no leadership. Combedi becomes the leader because of his charisma, but he's not formally. Movements were very spontaneous on the streets of Paris, as they were in 2013 in Brazil. No single leadership came out of the huge movements of 2013, and they also didn't have a program. It started with a very small thing, bus fares, but suddenly became something huge. And something huge that actually was saying to the government at the time, the problem is not you, the problem is this whole pact, the contract, the social contract we live in. This is not enough anymore. We want something different. What this thing is, we will discuss afterwards. Now we just want to say that we're not pleased with what we have. And this is probably the modernity of May 68. And Combedi embodies that. But of course, Sartre was right. when Sartre says, well, that's very interesting, but it's very hard to maintain this energy if you don't have a name. And if you don't, it will dissipate very rapidly, which in fact it did, as in Brazil it did in 2013, as it did Occupy, etc., etc., etc.
I had a million of other questions to ask, but given your wonderful eloquence covering so many of the points I wanted to make, I wanted to open to the audience. So.
Thanks. So firstly, and two things. For your film and really enjoying about your film is so splendid. Like, I come from China. What the things your mom shows in China is what Michelangelo Antonioni have not the chance to shoot. It's a so amazing archive film. And so another thing is because recently I'm doing a project based on my old family alibi, so I could like learn lots of things about your things. But I still have like some questions about like, because do you think your film is a little bit like too much melancholy or ambitious about the revolution and the 1960s? The thing is just like, for example, in the ending of the film, I really enjoy your put the film about leaving the factory. It's an amazing touch, but unfortunately, I think what like just like after 50 years, should we to explore the, because all the directors and the filmmakers are focusing on the gate from the workers come from the gate of the factory, but we didn't focus on the other side of the gate. Should we to go inside to explore the things? Which is, you already noticed that the questions in your film, but shall we to explore and to think about the things to in the act, but not to romanticization, doing the romanticization to the revolution.
So let me see if I can answer that. First of all, so 68 in Brazil is basically France. It kind of colonizes our imagination. In Brazil, when it chooses its 68, there's so many to choose, we choose France. And I have some theories about that. But we choose France before the march on the Champs-Élysées. We like to think that it was a complete victory, and it was not. And I think it's important to show that it was not. And it's important to respect those that went out into the streets, thought they could live in a different way, and lost. Lost not in history, but lost at the moment, there, you know? And we don't show what comes after 68 in May. We don't show June. And in June, de Gaulle reasserts his power, and you see all those deaths. I'm not picking them here out of, they were in fact many deaths after 68, and also many people who didn't die, who didn't go to the extreme of dying, but could not find their way back into life. So this has to be acknowledged, but this is not a failure, because 68 changed French society forever, but it changed, as I keep saying, it changes in historical time, and people live in biographical time. And it's very hard to see the changes, because they come very slowly. In Brazil in 2013, if you interview those who took part in 2013, they will say, well, we failed, and now we have a horrible Brazil. They're right about the horrible part of Brazil, but they're wrong about the fact that 2013 didn't leave anything. It will leave something very important, and it will change Brazil for the better, but not in 2 or 3 years, but in 10. And so it's not a film about the melancholy of failure, but it's a film that acknowledges that those people who were there and who did what they did, after it came to an end, they had to face the tough choices of how I go on without victory, and two, without the sense of being one with the world, one with my brothers and my sisters, one with history that I had during those 3 weeks. It's tough. You become part of something so much larger than you, and then you come back to your own self, and it's difficult. And by acknowledging that, I don't think I'm disrespecting them. To the contrary, about the last scene, the Lumière scene, it's there for two reasons. Reason number one, I think that the scene that most touchingly describes the end of May is the scene that's smack in the middle of the film, in which the worker is forced to go back to the factory. And she's forced to go back to the factory by two union workers linked to the Communist Party. And she's desperate. And I think that she's desperate because she actually thought on the promises of May. She thought that she could live in a different way. And now she realizes that she won't live differently. She will go back to that same horrible place and work for some small amount of money, increase in her wages. And so it was about wages. It was not about reinventing life. And the last scene, which is the Lumière scene, is just the opposite of that. So workers are not going to the factory, they're leaving the factory. And when you leave the factory, you go back to your family, to your dog, to your friends, you go eat, you go dance, so you go to life, and she's going to death in a sense. So it's an image of possibilities. Of course, it's very ambiguous because it's the boss who's shooting, that we know, right? Because the factory belonged to the Lumière brothers. So you could actually see the scene as a vigilance camera, CCTV camera, which makes it more interesting, I think, not less interesting. But still, you have workers ending their day and going out to life. That's one reason. The second reason is that this is a film that cannot be made without all those people who took their cameras and went out and filmed. And so it's a film that wouldn't exist without film. So by putting the first image that was ever shot in film, I kind of also pay homage to filmmakers and to those who actually used film as a medium to bear witness of history. So that's why it's there also.
There's a question there.
At the back.
At the back. Yeah.
Hi there. Thank you very much for a film which I felt was very granular in a way, in an age which isn't particularly granular. I was wondering, there seemed to be almost a conscious decision not to show that much violence in the film itself. But earlier you mentioned the words social contract. And oftentimes people talk about that being guaranteed by violence. What was the filmmaking decision there in terms of not showing explicit violence as a part of the film?
So that's an interesting thing about May. So May in France, in the events of May, depending of who's counting, but I think that the consensus is five people died. And, it was, and two people died in May and three people died in June, still the aftermath of the events of May. Funnily enough, the two people who died in May were not students, were not they were linked more. They were more to the right than to the left. So one of them is the policeman that you see his funeral here in the film, and the other one is a young man. He was 30 something, called Materon, and he was a professional. He worked in an office, and he was a supporter of De Gaulle, and he went down. And in Paris, he went down on the Rive Gauche on the 24th, the same day that the policeman died, to see what was happening. And he was found dead in the morning. Something exploded next to him. It's interesting to note that I couldn't find one single image of Matteron. It took me about 2 years to look for it, and I couldn't find. And I think that's also interesting in a sense, that because he was, let's say, from the right, we don't have an image of him. So we kind of choose who the corpses that we decide to represent, and that's also an interesting thing that I try to tackle in the film. I'm saying that because May was not particularly violent. There was a lot of violence by the riot police. A lot of knocking and heads in bloody hands and heads and eyes, etc. But images of that, the ones that exist are here. You don't have many of those images because it was very violent, and it usually happened late at night, because that's another thing about May, because as the film says, most of the government kids were in the barricades. They were very, very careful not to go with lethal force. So before the riot police entered into the barricades on the 10th and on the 24th, there was an order to take all the live ammunition. They didn't have live ammunition. They only had gas and they had porrete. I don't know how to say that. I mean sticks. Sticks, and they also were announcing that they were going to invade, and they only invaded after the last metro left in order to give time for people to leave through the subway. So you don't have very many images of that. May of 68 is basically it's very interesting to think also on how revolutions and social unrest is linked to the mediums in which it is transmitted. So you can start with the leaflets in the French Revolution, but May 68 is basically radio. So what you have on the violence of May 68, other than photographs, still photographs, is the tape of the 10th of May, where you hear violence but you don't see violence. Now, it was very violent in Czechoslovakia. More than 100 people died with the invasion. You don't have images of that for obvious reasons. It was, one, very dangerous to film. Two, censorship very quickly sets in. So you have 3, 4, 5 bodies that you see. Maybe one or two of them are in the film, I don't recall, but you don't see actual violence. And in Brazil, I choose only to show the funeral of Edson Luiz. There's an image of his corpse laid in Rio, but of the events in which he died, you don't have any image. So you will see much more violence in Mexico, of course, images of violence in Mexico. You will see it in the United States. You see it in Germany also. But you don't see as much in France, and you don't see it as much in Czechoslovakia. Although in Czechoslovakia it was fairly, fairly violent. In France it was fairly mild compared to the other events of 68 around the world. One more question.
If I may, just to complete, about your choice, just plugging into what you were just saying, the choice of countries that you made, you were saying that in those countries violence was not so prominent as it had been in other countries. So why did you pick up the Czech Republic, France, Brazil? And those little home movies that we see in the beginning of, you know, images in the Czech Republic and in Brazil.
Well,
it's an interesting choice.
So it started with the images of my mother, and very quickly it went to France because of very subtle reasons. They're not very Cartesian. One, reading about the militants of May, you can see the same kind of existential, movement that my mother experienced. Again, for different reasons, but the same kind of, I'm alive, I'm completely alive, I'm not alive anymore. We were in Paris at the time. We were living in Paris because my father was the minister of the deposed government in 64. There was a coup. We left. We went to Paris. And so I don't recall. I don't have any remembrance, but I was in May. I was there. I was living there. I was four. And because May, as I said to you, May, as you know, as a Brazilian, May is the 68 that we choose to prefer. It's very prevalent in the imagination of the 68 generation in Brazil, the influence of May, the influence of the events of May. Being a Brazilian, it's natural that you go there. And then Czechoslovakia. Very briefly, Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia for one reason. Czechoslovakia was when they didn't believe in the Soviet Union anymore, of course, in the model. 68 was as much against the United States, Vietnam, as it was against the Soviet Union, the whole model. And so in 68, after May, the whole generation had in Prague and in Cuba their guiding lights. This is where still we can dream of a socialism that can be a system where you have justice and at the same time liberty of expression, of et cetera. This is interesting, and this is where we're looking for our guidance. On the 21st of August, there was invasion, and so Chris Marker writes, as we are in an essay film festival, I know I can tell the name of Chris Marker, and you all know who he is. So Chris Marker writes, Chris Marker, who went into the factories to film the workers, actually. He started this movement in 67 to go into the factories and film the lives of workers inside the factories. It's another discussion. It wasn't the film. I took it off. And he writes, so we waited to see what Fidel Castro was going to say. And we thought that Castro was going to sever his relations with the Soviet Union after the invasion. And so they waited to see his pronouncement. And Castro, in fact, made a speech 2 days after. And you can see the speech on YouTube. It wasn't the film. It was not anymore. And it's a very impressive speech, because Castro says basically what just happened in Czechoslovakia is indefensible morally, because this is a country who has been invaded by its neighbors, and this cannot be defended morally. And then there's a silence, and he continues, but politically it's absolutely necessary that invasion succeeds, because we cannot let a country that is from the social sphere to migrate into the arms of the West. So although it's morally indefensible, it's politically necessary. And when he says that, Chris Marker writes, this is when the curtain of our generation fell. And that's when they didn't know where to look. They had a brief reprieve with Allende in 74. And we can say that the 70s were basically a Chilean decade. But in 68, when Czechoslovakia, the experiment of Czechoslovakia came to an end, a whole generation was left without mooring. And that's when the sadness, the sense that you don't know where to look, you don't have a way out anymore sets in. And to finalize, I think that the images of Czechoslovakia are truly, truly touching, because these are people who went out just to film. And it's very interesting also to see how films are different in different political contexts, how images made in France are complete opposite of the images made in Czechoslovakia, which is also something that interests me. Images depend on the political context they are made. So they shake in Czechoslovakia, they don't shake in France. They use telephoto lenses because they cannot approach the events in Czechoslovakia. They use wide angle lenses because they can approach in France because it's still a democracy. So the whole aspect of how do you analyze an image, seeing it into something, an object that is being produced because of a political context is also very, very interesting. And the contrast between May and France is striking. Finally, Brazil, because I'm Brazilian, and because I think that the funeral of Edson Luiz is very telling about how political people who died in political circumstances become martyrs, basically.
For those of you who don't know, the images of that funeral of Edson Luiz were captured by both Eduardo Escorel, who is the editor of this film, and by Carlos Avelar, who was a fantastic film critic, who was the witness of the whole history of Brazilian cinema, but unfortunately died very recently. So, yeah, precious
footage. Thank you very much for staying so late. It was a pleasure.